Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.podomatic.com. Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode number 113 of Luke's English Podcast. And this one is called Setting the World to Rights. So what does this expression mean? Well, according to the Macmillan Dictionary, it means to have a conversation with someone in which you exchange opinions on a range of subjects, especially opinions on how to solve society's problems. That's exactly what I did in this episode. Listen and you'll hear me engaging in conversation with a colleague of mine named Eamon. We went to the pub for a quick pint and ended up setting the world to rights. Eamon is a very intelligent and interesting guy, and I'm sure you'll enjoy listening in on our conversation. I've decided it will help you immensely if you can read some of the phrases we use in this episode, and so I've written many of those things in a list, which you can find on the website, which I'm sure you have remembered by now is teacherluke.podomatic.com. Go to episode 113 and you'll see a list of expressions which Eamon and I used in our conversation. And what you can do is just have a look at those expressions and make sure that you understand exactly what they mean. And then when you listen again, you'll fully understand everything that we say in our conversation. So that's pretty much it from me in this introduction. And now you can settle down and enjoy the interview. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to another episode of Luke's English Podcast. And guess what? You might hear some music in the background. That's because I'm sitting in a pub. Now, you might get the impression from what I've been doing in the last few episodes that I spend my whole life either in pubs, near pubs, or thinking about going to pubs. But it's not really true. It's just that they're quite good places to hang out in England. Often, these are the meeting points. These are the places that we spend time with other people. So I happen to be in a pub. If you hear music, that's normal in a pub. There's always a bit of light background music going on. So that's probably what you can hear in the background there. Now, in this episode, I'm with Eamon, who's someone I work with. I sit next to him at the moment in the teacher's room. And so I thought, because he's an excellent conversationalist, I thought that I would ask him to talk to us, to talk to me and talk to you, the listeners, on Luke's English Podcast. I'm sure he's privileged and delighted to join us. So hello, Eamon.
Hi, everyone. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here. And, over to you, Luke.
I am the host, so, you know, anytime you wonder what to say next, just point the microphone back to me and that's okay. Fine. So, your name's Eamon Shanahan, right? Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that an Irish name?
Yes, it is, Luke. It's an Irish name. Eamon is Irish for Edmund. And, of course, I was named the first president of the Irish Republic, Eamon de Valera, who, in fact, was a horrible man. So, but he was nonetheless an iconographic figure. And Eamon is quite... It's quite a nice name, actually. Throughout the years, it's been the one thing about myself I've always liked.
the one thing. Surely there are other things that you like about yourself, Eamon.
Well, yes, that's all right. That was just a bit of a joke. Yeah, Eamon Shanahan. Yeah, a very Irish name.
Okay. So, are you Irish or British or what? Because you have lived a lot of your life in the UK, but are you British or are you Irish?
Well, I consider myself British, Irish British, if you like. I was born and raised in London, and. As I'm sure many of people who are listening now, London is often described as one of the great super cities. It's almost a culture in its own right. It's almost a country in its own right. And I feel very at home in London culture, if I leave London and go into sort of small English villages, I do become aware of a cultural distinction between my upbringing, certainly in my home, and the upbringing of those around me. And I do feel Irish in typically English situations, but in London I don't. I just feel part of this city very much.
So do you feel like the real British identity, or sort of what really makes Britain British, is found not in London but maybe in rural parts of the country? Do you think so?
No. I feel what's British is found in the big cities, you know, like London, Glasgow, Dublin.
Careful. Okay. Dublin's not in Britain. There might be listeners who get very tetchy about that.
Okay, well, to the tetchy listeners, I would say that there's a political distinction between the north and south of Ireland, but in fact, if you look at the history of these islands, we're all intertwined, you know, happily and unhappily, sure, but that's history. For me, the British... the British imagination includes Ireland, Wales, Scotland and England in various, combinations over the years. And then there's London. London, London.
I get the feeling you like London, eh? All right. All right. Now, you're an English teacher, but how did you end up being an English teacher then, Eamon?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I went to university and studied languages, French and Spanish, and when I left university, it was my intention to avoid going into a job. In those days, happily, there was plenty of money available for students. We called them grants, and we didn't have loans, so I managed to secure a grant to study law. A postgraduate law course. So, without thinking very much about it, as one does when one is young, I just enrolled in this course and found it quite interesting. Unfortunately, after 2 years, I had to go and be a lawyer. And this was my introduction to the world, and I kind of grew up a bit and for 4 years worked as a lawyer. I wasn't a very good lawyer, and I wasn't a very happy lawyer. And I decided to change from there, and I got into teaching. I started teaching law at university. And then I started teaching English because it was English as a foreign language was beginning to boom, and jobs were easy to get in London. And my lifestyle was becoming increasingly dissolute. And,
do you mind if I ask you what do you mean by that?
Well, dissolute means, it's sort of, you know, I didn't really want to get up early in the morning, and I really did enjoy life after midnight, and London was having a great time. This was the 1980s, you know, gay rights were coming out, you know, all-night partying, rave music, dance music, and it was just a great time to party, and, you know, one simply didn't have the time to work.
So, wait a minute, The life of a lawyer is quite hard, isn't it? Because you have to work long hours, and it's like there's a lot of pressure, especially if you have to, I don't know, sort of present in court, or you know, talk in front of a judge, or even just write very, very important documents and things. But what you wanted to do was go out and party like it was 1999, I suppose. What was it exactly about being a lawyer that didn't suit you then?
The career structure and the workaholic culture. I mean, it's just ridiculous, really. You had to spend all your life working. And when you weren't working, you were recovering from work, you know. You were too tired to love, and I wasn't going to have that, was I?
No way. No way, sir. So after becoming an English teacher, did you just teach in London, or did you teach in other countries?
I taught in London only for years. In fact, up until about 5 or 6 years ago, when I moved to Croatia, and I've been teaching over there now, and I teach between the two places.
Yeah. What was it about Croatia that attracted you? Why Croatia, of all places?
Well, principally, my very beautiful wife, who comes from Croatia, And it was a country I've been going to for years, since I met her. And also, I was attracted, yes, I've devoted, as you might have gathered, I've devoted a large part of my adult life avoiding proper jobs, apart from the odd blip as a lawyer.
Wait a minute, are you saying that being an English teacher isn't a proper job?
Absolutely, Luke. Yes, I am.
Okay.
No, I think what it is, that was a bit facetious. No, English teaching can be a very serious job if you want it to be, but it can also be offer you a very flexible working structure. My wife felt similarly. When we started to have a family, we both of us wanted to be very involved in bringing our children up, and we also quite liked each other's company. We wanted to see a lot of each other, so we managed to buy some property in Croatia quite cheaply, and that meant that we didn't have to work so much. So we have a good lifestyle, in that sense.
I'm impressed by your lifestyle, because you get to spend sort of large parts of the year in your property in Croatia, which I understand is a beautiful country with like a lot of things to offer. Mm-hmm. And then every now and then you can come back to London and come back to the London School of English and do the odd course here and there, and it seems to suit you very well, I think.
Yeah, no, it does. No, I'm very happy. Croatia is a complicated country. It is very beautiful, as people say. You know, it's got great coastline and stuff. But it's also a deeply troubled culture, and I sometimes worry that maybe I'm shortchanging my children by bringing them up there. But I console myself that these days culture is less grassroots and more mediated. And what I mean by that is that I think that my children and the youth of Croatia are having actually very similar experiences to the youth of Shanghai, New York, and small towns in Devon, England. And this is because increasingly culture is mediated through the web and the internet. And so maybe my children won't be, you know, so shortchanged.
You think that even though they're in Croatia, they will still be able to participate in a kind of international culture? They won't miss out on the things that they might miss out on if they weren't living in London, because they can get it all through the internet, you mean? Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Yeah. So what about life in Croatia? I mean, let's just talk about some everyday things. Is it different to life in London? And have you found any, have you found any, like, common things that you find different or strange about living in Croatia?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Croatia is a very different place. I mean, I think the first thing to say about it is it's compared to London, it's a provincial culture. London is a very urbane place, and I find when I come, I travel between the two. When I've been in Croatia for a long time and I come to London, my first impression is always the same, and it's always quite strong. London people seem very grown up, independent, and expressive. And when I go back to Croatia, I find Croatians, you know, basically more inhibited. You know, they haven't been allowed to grow internally, you know, intellectually, spiritually, and socially, in a way that Londoners have, and it's basic as that, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I mean, on a sort of more, let's say, on a more basic level, are there little details? Because when I go to other places, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm not always on the sort of I'm not always as profound as I get the impression you are sometimes. I find that I notice little things like, I don't know, like the way that they organise their apartments, or the way that they behave on public transport, things like that. For example, in Japan, on the trains, the culture is that you don't make any noise and that you're very silent, and that you're very respectful of other people, and you're very sort of, you know, keep yourself to yourself, you keep your private things private. And yet at the same time, it's quite normal to fall asleep on the train and fall asleep with your head on the shoulder of a stranger, and that's okay. That kind of invasion of privacy is perfectly okay, but talking to a stranger about their personal life would be like really out of the question. So similar in London, that you wouldn't talk to a stranger about their personal life, but you certainly wouldn't fall asleep with your head on their shoulder, because that would be a huge invasion of their personal space. So that's an example of the way in which I find Japanese culture to be different, in just a sort of little specific way.
Okay.
Have you noticed anything like that in Croatia?
Yeah, I have. Again, the biggest one is I find London, when I was young, London had a reputation for being a rather rude and unfriendly city. But I think that's changed. I think London's become a kind of a brighter, happier community to when I was young.
Yeah.
And very polite, you know, very well mannered. And when I go back to Croatia, the manners are dreadful. And Croats have a bad reputation for being ill mannered and surly. And as far as I can tell, both are justified.
Really? You said that London seems to be brighter and sort of happier and all that sort of thing. But what about, I think it was last year, was it last year? We had the riots, didn't we?
Indeed.
And large parts of London were sort of basically burning as a lot of very, apparently very unhappy people decided that they would smash the place up.
Yeah.
Now, what's going on there? Don't you think that shows that London isn't really that happy?
I'm very glad you mentioned that, Luke. In fact, I was in London at the time with my family. And
you weren't involved in the riots.
I was very close to them. I was in Tooting with my family, and when it all kicked off, I was outside making sure everything was locked, and I made sure I was armed. It was Wild West stuff. So I really did experience those very uncomfortable days. And I think the Monday night, we were all pretty frightened, because there obviously weren't enough policemen in London to deal with what was happening. And yeah, okay. I think London is also a much, much richer town than when I was young. When I was young, a millionaire was a celebrity. These days, they're all over the place. You know, you have to be a billionaire to get noticed. And with that has come this discrepancy between the rich and the poor. And I think those riots were a classic manifestation of people who felt that they had been left out of the enrichment process, and whose values had somehow curdled and become very material, you know, and they just wanted the trainers. You know, it was very disappointing. I mean, if it had been a riot about, you know, working conditions or living conditions, we would have got behind it, of course, but it wasn't. They just stole stuff.
I get the impression that it started as a way of, it started as a kind of protest against the way in which the police were treating people in certain parts of the city. And then on the back of that, it just became a free-for-all, you know, a chance for people to just loot shops and things. Interesting what you said about these people who don't feel they're part of the consumerist culture. And I really agree with that. I think that there is a huge consumer culture in the UK. And, you know, we're bombarded with advertising left, right and centre. And we're constantly given messages that in order to be happy and to be a successful person, you need to buy certain goods and you need to get this kind of TV and these sorts of clothes and things like that. And there are people who live in sort of poor areas of the city who can't afford any of this stuff, and yet they're exposed to all of these adverts and things as well. And so, of course, naturally, they want to get those things, and yet they know, they realise that somehow they're being given a bad deal. It's still wrong. It's still wrong for them to break into shops and steal things. It's definitely wrong, but I think that they were kind of pushed over the edge. Maybe we're being a bit liberal. Some people would say that there's no excuse for criminality and all that kind of thing. Where do you stand on that? If one of your kids had been involved in the looting, how would you have dealt with it?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I get your point about, you know, one's liberal sentiments. I have very mixed feelings about those riots, and I don't really know where I stand. You know, I'm a bit shocked at the belief that the acquisition of things can make a difference to your life. You know, how bad is it, how has it got that, you know, just people want flat screen TVs and trainers? And I think we're in a bad way in that respect. On the other hand, I was on the night that it happened, I was just thinking, where are the police? And then bring in the army, you know. And I was protecting my children, and, you know, I found myself having sentiments of a rather less left-wing liberal.
You were like, get them, get these bloody looters, smash them up. What can I, do you mind if I ask what you were, you said you armed yourself. Mm-hmm. What did you arm yourself with, like a cricket bat, base, you know, golf club? What, what was it that you had?
They were shears. Gardening shears.
The kind of tool that you'd use to cut... I can't believe you were armed. I can't believe you were armed with gardening shears. These listeners, gardening shears are like a sort of big pair of scissors that you would use to cut a hedge. You know, a hedge is like a, let's say, a kind of bush that you'd have in your back garden. We use gardening shears to cut the hedge. This is before we had electric gardening equipment. So gardening shears, imagine a big pair of scissors. I think, I'm sure you know what I mean. So you were armed with a pair of gardening shears, and what were you going to do when, let's say, a looter smashed through the front door and said, where's all your stuff? Give me all your branded goods and money. What would you have done with the gardening shears at that point?
Well, Luke, I'm ashamed to say I was ready to clip their wings.
Bring those looters back down to earth. A bit of dose of Eamon reality, let's say. Okay. All right. Fine. Okay. Well, where can we go from here, Eamon? Do you think that the Olympics made a difference to this culture? Do you think, because like the Olympics were all part of a way to somehow refresh things in London, and they took place in the East, which is known for being an area of poverty and not a very developed area. So the part of the Olympic bid was to try and redevelop that area, and the catchphrase for the Olympics was to inspire a generation. Do you think the Olympics is going to inspire a generation?
Right, well, I'm not sure. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of propaganda, and the whole development issue is actually quite controversial, Luke, and I think we could almost devote another podcast to that. It's tempting to say, obviously, it's a good thing, but in fact, a great deal of grassroots culture was destroyed to make way for much of the Olympics construction. But for me, the Olympics didn't change us, but the Paralympics did. I think the Paralympics were extraordinary. Images on TV that we had never seen before, discussions about disability that we had never entered into before, black humour, and I believe we have liberated a whole new voice, you know, the voice of the disabled, and that can only be a good thing. And I really believe that London was the best place for it, because we have a combination of wealth and sensitivity and humour and style, if you like, to pull it off. And pull it off we did. And that was the great achievement of this summer, the Paralympics.
Okay. I think the Paralympics is amazing because the potential that there is in the Paralympics. Because, you know, the thing about the Olympics is that that a lot of it's really controlled. So, for example, doping, technology, these are all kind of outlawed to an extent. Like, they have to try and make sure that the athletes perform just as people, you know, that they have to make sure they're not using any other kind of, let's say, technology or pharmaceuticals to help them, right? But in the Paralympics, there's this idea that it's a combination between, in some of the events anyway, and in some of the athletes, a combination of the person and the technology, the developments of the technology. Like, for example, some of the runners use these, I don't know how exactly you describe them, but they're kind kind of like
running blades.
Running blades, I think they call them.
Yeah.
And they're attached to the bottom of the legs of the athletes, and they run with these blades. And I wonder if eventually, when the technology gets to the right stage, these blades and this technology will really allow people to do incredible things. That where will the Paralympics go? You know, we might have some incredible technology being used, and it could be really amazing spectacle.
Well, I look forward to this whole debate about technology and human endeavour being developed. You know, this whole business of doping seems to me to be a troublesome area, a difficult area, because it's like crime. You know, the criminals are always ahead of the authorities, and it seems to be the same in doping. And the Paralympics is now becoming a big thing, a commercial thing. There's going to be a lot of money and power involved in it. And I believe, you know, Paralympians, they're only human, are going to start using, shall we say, technological support in terms of, you know, what kind of drugs can they take and can't they take. And I look forward to an Olympics or a Paralympics where anything goes.
Yeah.
And we just see who's the most inventive, chemically, technically, prosthetically, and let's just see how fast we can run and how high we can jump, Luke.
Exactly, I totally agree. I want to see exactly how fast a person can go before they explode. You know? Let's make that happen. If we just, you know, totally, maybe we should create an alternative Olympics where it's like, okay, no regulation,
absolutely,
go for it, go for your lives. You know, there have to be lots of insurance, you know, to make sure the athletes know exactly what they're entering into. But once they are willing to do it, we should go for it.
And how about an alternative society where anything goes too, Luke?
Well, I think you might need to, I don't know who you should talk to about that. Write a letter to the government. I don't know what they're going to do about it. Yeah, a society where anything goes. Wow.
Anything goes. We work 3 days a week. So we should. We've got 4 days a week to devote to our relationships and fun. And where what bothers me is prohibition. I really don't like prohibition, Luke. I believe that, you know, my human rights are being violated.
Yeah.
Frankly, when someone prohibits me from doing something. You know, John Stuart Mill, a great British man, who wrote the one of the great essays of all time on liberty.
Philosopher.
And he said that, you know, man and woman, of course, but in those days they said man with a capital M,
yeah.
Man should be free to do anything he likes apart from harming another human being. And that is very much where I come from. And so we don't like prohibition. And I think we need to tell the Americans that, Luke.
Well, they learned a bit about prohibition in the 30s, of course, and they realized it didn't work. But what about... I agree with that question of we should be allowed to do whatever we want as long as it doesn't harm another person. But how do we measure it, what harms other people or not? Because there's always the chance that what... You know, when you look at it for the first time, you might say, for example, I don't know, smoking, let's say, if you do it at home, doesn't harm other people. But maybe it does in other ways. Maybe somehow, because if more people smoke, that means the NHS, the National Health Service, has to look after those people, so it's more of a tax burden and all that sort of thing. How do we decide what harms other people and what doesn't? Where do you draw the line?
Okay. Very good question and a very good point. And I think what we have to learn to live with is a certain ambiguity and uncertainty, and whereby each human in each situation has to make judgments, moral judgments, based on, you know, how they feel the consequences of their actions will impact on other people. What I don't like is, you know, coming from central office, a black and white prohibition, you must do this or you must do the other. And the fact is that the interaction of billions of human beings is a very complex issue. And we, what I look forward to is, you know, a world, a society where people are sufficiently developed and grown up to handle complexity, uncertainty, and ambiguity. and allow themselves to go into situations and make moral and social choices, which are, you know, for the benefit rather than the detriment of others.
I think you've just described my ideal listener to Luke's English podcast, because I think the people out there who regularly listen to Luke's English podcast, I imagine, have to put up with a certain amount of ambiguity. You know, they've got to be quite tolerant people in order to put up with, I don't know, maybe those moments when I talk nonsense about various things. They also have to realise that that maybe is something that they have to put up with in their general life. Do you think that, you know what? Do you want another drink?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, all right, let's do that. It's been great to talk to you, Eamon. Thanks very much. I'm sure that all my listeners will agree that you're a great conversationalist, and I think maybe we've set a new high point in terms of the depth that we've gone into in this episode of Luke's English Podcast. In many cases, I just talk about, like, who would win in a fight between Spider-Man and Batman, for example. And I'd go into that in quite a lot of detail. But today we really kind of got to the heart of some deeply important issues relating to human rights, sort of society, and other related issues. But anything else to say to the people of the world before end this interview, Eamon?
Thanks a lot for those really kind words, Luke. People of the world, work less, love more. That's all I can say.
Right, and I think on that note, we'll stop recording here. Thank you very much. I think you will probably hear more from me, but for the moment, thank you very much, and goodbye. Bye, bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Luke's English Podcast. Don't forget to visit teacherluke.podomatic.com for more information.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.